Alan Kring Productions presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 2 for Autumn Semester 2018. Lecture 12, delivered on September 27, 2018. The title of this lecture is Annuities and Perpetuities.
Today, annuities and perpetuities. To start off with a simple problem, and I'm going to have you use your calculators here fairly regularly in this class. Simply because if we do them by hand, I mean, it's just a lot more like work. But let me do this real quick. Just a quick, dirty question. You purchased a stock today for $18.75. You will receive a dividend in 1 year of $1.25 and another dividend in 2 years of, let's say, $1.50, at which time you'll sell the stock for $19.75. If you discount cash flows at 8%, did you make a good investment? Now, this is actually a twist on a classic problem. And what we're going to do is we're going to look at this as the present value of an unlevel annuity. See, what happened here was, regardless of what you paid for it at year zero, at year one and at year two, at year one you're going to get $1.25. And at year two you're going to get $1.50. And you are also going to sell the stock for $19.75. So this is an annuity. It's a two-year annuity. It's unlevel, and it is an ordinary annuity. Ordinary because the cash flows occur at the end of the period. Unlevel because they're not the same amount in each period. Well, you know, this is kind of a pain in the butt. I'm going to show you a little trick in, can I do that? Yeah, I can do this in the calculator. We can tell whether this is a good, but let me do it by hand first, and then I'll show you a way you can do it on the calculator. And that way you're going to do it on the calculator, you will use for more traditional types of problems in a few lectures here. Let me find a better marker. This one's kind of giving out on me. Okay, so what I'm going to do is I'm going to take $1.25 back as a lump sum, 1 plus 0.08 to the negative 1, and take this guy back, which was 1975, 2075, 2125, discounted back two periods, and add those up. And if I do that, let me pull up the calculator. I'm going to pull up the TI-83 to do it, just to start getting the better habit of doing that one. Okay, on. So in this case, what I would do is I would take 1.25 times 1.08 to the negative 1 plus 21. Is that right? Yeah, 21.25 times 1.08 to the negative 2, $19.38. So was it a good buy or not? Did I do a good investment or not? What did I pay for it? What was it worth? What's it worth right now? So is it a good buy or not? Yes. You've just found a good investment. We would say that this was a positive net present value investment. Okay? Now I'm going to show you a trick on the calculator. It's not really a trick. It's one of our most classic tools on one of these calculators. And you can do it for things other than what it's really designed for. Watch this. Okay, I'm going to clear. Apps. Finance, or finance for you folks from Decatur. Sorry, I shouldn't do that. That's evil. And I'm going to go down to 7, which is net present value. Now, a net present value is good if it's positive. It's bad if it's negative. It's that simple. Positive, good. Negative, bad. That's all there is to a net present value. There's no, its number is actually irrelevant. It's all that matters is whether it's positive or negative. So I'm going to say, let's do NPV, which is 7. Now, what I'm going to do first is I'm going to put in my discount rate, 8%. Now, remember, when you're bringing things back, you're discounting. When you're taking things forward, you're compounding. I don't know if I had ever actually said that before. But when we pull things back to the present, we call that discounting. And when we take things to the future, we call it compounding. Okay, 8%, comma. Now, you put in, as a negative, you put in negative $18.75. Now, everything in this financial calculator, these apps like this, commas flag new number. A comma is always a flag of a new number. Now, the next thing is that in this calculator, if you put something in braces, not parentheses, not brackets, but in braces, that tells a TI-83 that you have a cash flow. You're announcing, here comes a cash flow. So I'm going to say second parenthesis, which invokes the brace, the open brace. Okay. Now, just put in the positive cash flows. Okay, 1.25, 1.25, comma. Again, the comma says here comes a new number. And then I'm going to put in the 21.25, 21.25. Now, you're going to tell the calculator, I'm done with the cash flow. In other words, second, close the brace. The braces say, here is a cash flow. And it traps in the open close in the braces. And now close the, you open with parentheses to invoke the functions parameters. Close it, say enter. See, it's positive.
That tells you, yes, it's a good investment. Don't worry about the number. Actually, again, the number hardly ever means much of anything. It's just positive or negative. It's positive here, that's good. So that is, and I'll show you, now imagine this. The net present value is used for project analysis. Imagine that you had a cash flow from a corporate analysis. You're looking at a project that's going to last 10 years. You got all these unlevel things pounding out at you across this for 10 years. Imagine doing it by hand, and then imagine just putting it into this calculator. It's a lot faster to do it this way. Now, in this one, it wouldn't have been that hard to do the whole thing, you know, with this. But when you've got a long stream of cash flows, the TI-83 can do it. Excel can do this. There's nothing hard about it whatsoever. Now, very quickly, just to pull it out in Excel, I mean, year, cash flow, and then over here we'll put the discount rate, put it over here somewhere. And we'll put in 8%. Now the year, 0, 1, 2, and then out of your pocket came $18.75. 18.75. Then in came $1.25. And then in came $21.25. And then you can just get your NPV. And that equals NPV, open the parenthesis, and you give it the rate right here. Now, don't type a rate in. Always put it somewhere so that you can change it, play with it. In other words, don't directly key anything in. Oddly enough, this has been known for forever in coding, but in websites, it was only about 10 years ago that we figured out, don't put text right into the code. Put in the call to the text, and then put the text over here so you can change it whatever you want without going back into the code itself. So that was a big thing that jumped us into the world of what are called the W3C standards. But anyway, use your rate right there, 8%, and your values, okay, comma, and then you just sweep down your values, close the parentheses. Now, I'm not sure it's going to like that 8% there. It probably will, though. Yeah, it did. It's okay. Now, imagine you have a long spreadsheet of cash flows going out years. It's just, boom, it's there. And then you say, oh, my bad, I didn't mean 8%. I meant, let's say, 7%. Oh, I meant 5%. What's happening as I lower the discount rate? Let me do it again. Oh, I meant 4%, 3%. What's happening to the, now this is important. I'm giving you answers to homework questions here. They're going to ask you this, okay? And these are the ones that I notice people, you can do the calculation pretty fast, but when they ask you these kinds of questions, you start, I'm not sure. Look at it. What's happening as I lower the discount rate? Did you see it? What? Talk to me. Increased. Yeah, because essentially what you're doing is you are not dragging those future values down as much. See, because you divide by that percentage, 1 plus a percentage, and so the smaller it is, the less that denominator is dragging down, discounting the future cash flows. So in other words, at high discount rates, you have low present value. At low discount rates, you have high present value. Again, discount rate, present value.
high, low. Discount rate high, present value low. Discount rate low, present value high. Now, interestingly, with future value, a high discount rate elevates future value. A high discount rate elevates. In other words, you're compounding at a bigger rate, so your future values are higher. But if you're compounding at a low rate, you're not making hardly any money in the future. So the future value is lower. Keep that table somewhere in your notes or write it down somewhere so that you have that for your... there are a couple of questions where they ask you variations on this. And there's also some place at the end of this lecture I'm going to show you why one of the reasons your future is going to suck so much. It actually has to do with this. You see, what happens with pension plans is they figure out, okay, we want people to have a specific amount of money when they retire so that they can get an annuity, a cash flow for the rest of their lives. They want to put money into an account so that you have a big amount out here so that you can tap that down as your life goes on from there. The problem was that they were figuring that they would be able to invest money at very high rates to get the defined amount out here, which means that they didn't have to ask people to put big premiums in. But that was just absolutely ridiculous. They were compounding at a ridiculously high rate, so they didn't have to have very much money along the way to get the defined amount they needed out here. It turned out that they couldn't do it. Legally, they couldn't do it. So it turns out that all this money they were putting in here is not very much at all. And so these promised payments out here just cannot be made with that amount that was collected up to the retirement age. That's the core of the crisis. And it's all over the place in public and private pension plans. So anyway, that's your future, not mine. Anyway. But hey, let me get off that kick here for a minute. I'm going to bring back the Excel sheets here over the course of this lecture. We're going to do what's called an amortization table a little later on. But the first things first here is you've now seen one of our premier things that we do with this. Some of these problems are really easy. Some of them, if you try to do them by hand, it takes quite a bit of effort. And trial and error is part of it, too. But you don't have to do that with a calculator. Okay. Let me think. You want to put $15,000 in the bank now. And be able to withdraw $2,000 for each of the next 10 years. What investment rate would accomplish this?
Here we're looking for a target investment rate, and this one would be absolutely, well, it's not impossible. It would just be a whole lot like work, because you'd have to guess at an investment rate, see what happens, and then figure out from there, okay, let's try another one. You'd be a lot of trial and error to accomplish this. But what we're talking about is, at its heart, just a plain old annuity. It begins with $15,000 in, and then one, two, three. Is it hot in here, or is it just me? Yeah, if I had an apple in my mouth, I think I was at a luau. Okay, and you want $2,000 back out. By the way, I don't know if I ever mentioned this. This looks like I'm doing this for you. I'm actually doing this for me. Drawing timelines is amazingly useful. Unless you are a really visual person who also happens to be a quantitative person, drawing a timeline just clarifies a lot, and it makes it a lot easier to see how you proceed. Well, essentially, this is nothing but a level ordinary annuity. It's just a plain old $2,000 a year for 10 years, and the payments start at the end of the period. And we have the present value of it. So this is a problem where what we're actually trying to do is, well, go into your calculator. This calculator turns off to save battery. On. I'm going to clear it. Okay, now, apps, finance, TVM solver. How many years? 10. What percentage rate? We don't know the percentage rate this time. But what's the present value? Negative $15,000. And we want the payments to be $2,000. See, you can put in any payment, anything, and the future value, there's no kicker at the end of this one. Now, you might want to say, well, at the end, I want an extra $500 for a really great meal at Red Robin. No, actually, $500, that's one double cheeseburger and... Anyway, okay, now go back up to your I percent and just solve it. Alpha, solve. 5.60% will do it. That's all there is. But imagine if you actually had to do that by hand. You'd have to try an interest rate, discount all the 2,000s back to see how close you got to 15,000, and then do it again and again and again, until you've got an interest rate that was close enough that you say, that's it. Here, just boom, a 5.60% interest rate should do the trick on this. But I know, it's just like... any minute now, I'm going to do something really radical here. God, I should have brought some barbecue sauce for myself there. Okay, that's that. Now, almost any way you cut it, when you open those and you're going to say, oh my God, all those problems, if you look at them, they're all pretty much just the same problem, just finding a different number that you need for it. I'm going to show you something here. Real quick. If I can find it here. Oh, one thing it kind of mystifies me. It's one of those things that textbooks still do, even though you don't need to know it hardly at all. There's almost no reason to do it anymore, to know it. It's one of those pieces of information that should be relegated to the past. But for some reason, it is traditional in textbooks to do this. And I think it's sort of like an anchor to the past. Everything that we do in interest rates and finance and a lot of things is based upon compounding and discounting. Compounding and discounting. In other words, interest on interest. That's compounding. That's the way anything that you're going to do is calculated. Of mortgages, car loans, bonds, all of that kind of stuff. They're all based on the same idea of compounding and discounting. Interest, in other words, interest on interest. There was an old way that was used before compounding. And there was actually compounding came about mostly because of something I'll tell you about here in a few minutes. But there is this thing called simple interest. Simple interest never calculates the interest on interest you've earned. It always calculates it on the original amount. So let's say 8% you invest $5,000 at 8% for 6 years. Now, simple versus compounding, compounded. Simple interest, you would say $5,000 plus $5,000 times 8% for 6 years. That's how simple interest works. Notice that all the interest is being calculated on is the original principal amount. That would be $30,000 times, that'd be $2,400, is that right? Or $240. God, I suck at arithmetic. Okay. $5,000 plus $5,000 times 0.08 times 6, $7,400. With the compounding, you do 5,000 times 1 plus 0.08 to the sixth power. 5,000 times 1.08 to the sixth power. 79.34.37. The compounding, and that's just one compounding per year. That's one compounding per year. Obviously, the compounding makes more money. That takes us to what was going on. Now let me show you something else here. Suppose that this would have been in the case of one period. Two periods would have been 5,000 times 1 plus 0.08 over 2 to the 6 times 2. Four periods, quarterly, and I'll just stop at quarterly, would have been 5,000 times 1 plus 0.08 over 4 to the 6 times 4. And just really quickly running those 5,000 times 1.08 to the, oh, I didn't mean to do that. Open the parenthesis, 1 plus 0.08 divided by 2, close the parenthesis, to the 6 times 2, should give us 8,516. And then with four periods, compounding four times a year, it would be 5,000 times, open parenthesis, 1 plus 0.08 divided by 4, close the parenthesis, to the 6 times 4 should give us 8,042.19. 8,042. So notice something here. As the number of compoundings per year go up, you make a little more. It's actually kind of, if you look at that, that's actually not shabby. Just going from annual to quarterly jumped you about $47 or something. Well, actually, it jumps you more than that. $6,600 more over 6 years. So the number of compoundings does matter. And that's one thing when you're looking at accounts, savings accounts. Look at how many compoundings they're offering you per year. A lot of them just, they don't say, and it turns out it's only compounded annually. But some of them, if they're more competitive, they'll look at it, you look at it and you'll see. As a matter of fact, I was looking at a couple last night just to see how common more than one compounding per year was. I found a couple of banks that were offering daily compounding on any account that has more than $5,000 in it. So there you go. Okay, now, where did this all come from? In the 1920s, and I had told you about this before, banks were just unregulated. They were just going crazy. They were offering whatever interest rate you wanted to hear. You want to invest? Well, you're thinking, no, maybe not. I'll tell you what. I'll offer you 20% interest. And then sleazy banker jumps the shark and says, I'll offer you 30%. And then this hoe handle over here, 50%. Literally, they were offering ridiculous interest rates that they were never going to be able to pay back. But hey, it was good times. Wonderful. Very pro-business environment. The best regulation is no regulation and all that. Well, it all came to an end rather quickly. Black Monday sort of started it off. As a matter of fact, if I recall right, we're approaching the anniversary of Black Monday, which is sort of scary. I'll be glad when that day passes. Black Monday was the day in 1929 when the whole thing went to hell. The stock market crashed. It just, everything. The thing of it was that the warning signs were all over the place several years at least before the crash itself of the stock market happened. And I mean, by 1929, there was beginning to be fairly apparent that there was a real problem. But the administration, the leaders in Congress managed to skate through the 1930 elections, swearing to God it was everyone but their fault. And businesses were very capable of keeping anyone from figuring out who it was, but by the Great Recession bit in, and it was ugly. A series of insanely stupid missteps by the president just added to the fuel to the fire. And in 1932, the rascals were all kicked out of Congress. I mean, and a new president was put in. I mean, it was just a bloodbath at the 1932 election. It was ugly. And so we got into this era of very strong regulation. I mean, serious. No more of this nonsense. A series of laws were passed reforming regulatory agencies, adding regulatory agencies, cracking down on the securities industry, cracking down on labor relations, the whole nine yards. And at first, the Supreme Court, which had been appointed by presidents before, they just found everything unconstitutional, and then the president said, well, it doesn't say in the Constitution how many justices there should be. We just usually have 9, so I'm just going to start appointing justices. And that freaked out the Supreme Court, and they started finding constitutional everything that was being done. But one of the sets of laws that was passed specifically targeted banking. And all of the nonsense, the crap, the bull crap that had been going on. It was called Glass-Steagall Act, after the two Congress people that introduced it. The Glass-Steagall Act, it just cracked down on banks, put them under iron fist control. And it was detailed. I mean, it didn't leave out anything. Clearly, the writers of Glass-Steagall understood banking. All the different tricks and games and nuances, there was nothing left out of Glass-Steagall, including Glass-Steagall placed a cap on what interest rate a bank could offer on a passbook savings account. The Glass-Steagall Act said you cannot offer more than 5.25%. You cannot. That was it. Now, interestingly, at the time, interest rates were very low because there was money being printed hand over fist to try to get us out of the recession. So supply of money goes up, rental rate of money goes down, interest rates go down, like I told you in the last lecture. So interest rates were nowhere near this high, so banks just actually said, okay, you know, it's not going to affect us. It's like when gas is $1.50 a gallon, and we put a cap on it, gas cannot be more than $3.80 a gallon. Nobody cares. It's one of those ineffective price ceilings. And this was a price ceiling, but it had no effect because interest rates were so low. So cruise forward in time. Nothing is wrong with this. But then, interestingly enough, as the economy began to recover, and especially as you began to see the government borrowing heavily enough that interest rates were beginning to rise, and then with the war coming on, then interest rates began to rise more because manufacturing and production began to pick up. Well, interest rates started on investments started going up. And they started bumping closer and closer to 5.25%. And the banks were saying, hello, we are not allowed to offer more than 5.25%, but you've got all these other investments out here that are now pushing at us at 5.25%. So what the heck? And then there was no mood by Congress at that time to change Glass-Steagall. Look, you guys screwed the pooch. Don't cry to us. You are going to be forever under our fist. And that was probably the wrong approach. They should have been able to adapt a little bit. But banks figured out a way around this. Okay. Why don't we compound instead of do simple interest? You saw what happened when you see what happens when you compound? The same interest rate actually pays more. And then the next trick happened. You remember what I told you about effective rates? Effective rate is always 1 plus the APR over the number of compoundings to the number of compoundings minus 1. It's a real simple formula. Actually, I think your TI can actually calculate an effective rate. I've never done it that way. I just do it by hand. But look at this. Number of compoundings per year. Effective rate. With one compounding per year, it'd be 1 plus 0.0525 over 1 to the first power minus 1. Which would be 5.25%. I mean, that's just... But then the bank said, oh, what if we offered semi-annual compounding?
I mean, the law says we have to offer an APR.
Of 5.25%. It did not address compoundings per year. There was nothing in there that said we cannot compound twice a year. So what they did was that, watch what happens. If I do 1 plus, open parenthesis, 1 plus 0.0525 divided by 2 to the second power minus 1, 5.32%. The effective rate is going up. Well, what happens if we compound quarterly? Well, then it would be, open parenthesis, 1 plus 0.0525 divided by 4, close parenthesis, oops, boy, did I make a mistake there. Did you see that? Wow, that would have been a really nice interest rate. Insert a zero. To the fourth power, minus 1, 0.0535. Let me do 12. If you compound compound weekly, it would be 1 plus 0.0525 divided by 12, close the parenthesis, to the 12th power, minus 1, 5.38%. So in other words, by increasing the number of compoundings per year, you could create the effect of a higher interest rate without violating Glass-Steagall. It got to the point now there's actually daily compounding, which I'll just run it real quick here. That would be doing it the classic way, the 1 plus 0.0525 divided by 360, close parenthesis, to the 365 minus 1 is 5.47%. If you have an incredibly large amount of money, you can even beat this one. There is something called instantaneous compounding. Instantaneous compounding. But you're never going, not one of you is ever going to have enough money to get to an account that offers instantaneous compounding. But interestingly enough, it is not this formula. You have to use this weird thing using the natural constant E. E to the, I've never really done it on it. I shouldn't admit that, but I think E to the 0.0525, is that how it works? Oh, yeah, it does, minus 1. So if you instantaneously compound, you would earn 5.39%. But like I said, none of you are ever going to get that. I'm not either. I've seen it. I have actually seen accounts that were running at instantaneous compounding. And it's actually very strong when you're talking about accounts that have like payments of 9, 10, 12% to begin with, instantaneous compounding really knocks the effective rate on those kinds of accounts up quite significantly. Like, for example, E to the 0.12 is, 12 and 3 quarters. So a 12% account pays 12 and 3 quarter percent with instantaneous compounding. But I shouldn't tease you with that because you're never going to see it like I'm never going to see it for our own accounts. But anyway, there you are. Now I'm going to do something. I've got a document here. You don't even have to do interest rates. Growth rates, interest rates are just growth rates of fancy, one specialized kind of growth rate. So here, let me do something. I'll see if I've got it. isuprof.com/docs/ what did I call that thing? Coca-Cola rate.jpg. Was that it? No. Huh. isuprof.com, docs, Coca-Cola, I thought it would ask me. Wait, let me do this. See if I can get my own. It's pretty sad when you can't access your own, find something on your own website. Oh well. Nonetheless, I had a document I was going to show you, a Coca-Cola growth, Coca-Cola sales. Boy, it doesn't want me to find that document at all. Okay. Sales, I can't get it. I don't know where it is. Oh, well, anyway, I'll show you this. Okay. Over a period of time, you can actually find, for example, let me do something here. You start with this one. You invest $52.86 in a stock on January 28th, 2018. You sell it for $60.15 on October 5, 2021. What's your annualized yield? Capital gain yield. On this stock. Now, the first thing that you would want to do here is to simply take the ending value over the beginning value. We're not done, though, because we need another piece of this. You need how many years happen? How many years happened.
Now, there are a couple of ways that you can do this. And if you have your calculators out, there's a way to do this on your Windows or Mac calculator. Now, I want you to watch this. There's websites, and I think I showed you websites where you can go and get days and years and all that. But you actually have a calculator in Windows that can do it. Watch. See this calculator here? That one that's been there forever? I mean, that thing was there back. It's scary when Windows first started. Go over here in the left to those little horizontal lines. And there is, in the drop-down, you'll see date calculation. So the first thing you would want to do is tell it the date that you began this investment, which would be January 28th. January 28th, right there. The date when you are going to finish it, we're going to take you clear up here. What was that? The 5th of October what?
October 5th.
Well, really? Let me go the right way here, okay? That's the only pain in the butt is just having to scroll down. 21 October. What was the October 5? October 5. $1,345. Okay? So what you do is you take 1,345 divided by 365.25. So in other words, your investment ran for 3.6824 years. Now, the next trick, and I'm trying to show you all these. Some of them you'll remember, some of them you will forget because you don't. It's not really that important. My next trick now, what I need to do is take $60.15 over $52.86 and raise that to the 1 over that many years. It's always 1 over the number of years. Don't be fooled. If it's less than a year, that will be a decimal. It's just always 1 over the number of years. Now, here's a trick. Memory in this calculator is a pain in the butt because you've got so many. But you don't really need to worry about that for this problem. What was it? $60.15, 60.15, oops, sorry, open parenthesis, 60.15 divided by 52.86, was it? 52.86, close the parenthesis, y to the x, second answer. That gets you the last answer you actually calculated. Did you know about that one? Yeah, some of you are nodding. Some of you are kind of, minus one. Oh, I didn't do that right. I want that to the 1 over. Wow. Open parenthesis to the 1 divided by second answer. Wow. Okay, close parenthesis, minus 1. 3.57% return. In other words, this is kind of a really sucky investment. This one really sucks. But in other words, you don't have to be stuck doing just annuals.
It doesn't matter. All you have to do is just take 1 over the number of years. Don't forget to minus your 1 at the end, though. Don't forget to minus your 1. But regardless. Now, there's a problem. I was actually going to show you the problem in your homework. It's the true story of the growth rate of Coca-Cola sales in Europe leading up to World War II, from the time that it was developed, showing that the growth rate of sales, you can calculate, all right, here's the growth rate over this period, growth rate over this period, or the growth rate over, it's just not exactly like this. That's the only thing I wanted to point out to you. What's really scary, though, is what happens if you have a constant growth rate over an extraordinarily long period of time. So if you were to maintain the same growth rate on your product sales you sold 45,000 units last year and this year you sold 46,200 units. That implies a growth rate of 46,200 over 4,500 minus 1. Here's where the mistake can happen. 46,200 divided by 45,000 minus 1. So that's a growth rate of 2.67%. So, okay, let's use that as our projection so that what we could do is then apply that same growth rate for 10 years. What would that mean about the number of units sold in 10 years? This is where you have to have some caution. Add that 1 back in. Raise that to the 10th power. And then times the result by 45,000 units. 58,547 units. That's not bad. It's a reasonable, seems logical. You've got to watch it, though, because sometimes in your early years, you'll have very large growth rate of sales. And then companies apply that and project out, like, well, we had a 10% growth in sales our first year. So we're going to apply 10% and project revenues for the next 10 years growing at 10%. And suddenly you've got almost insanely impossible numbers. But sometimes that insanely impossible number is what happens, and that's what it was with Coke. No one thought at the time that Coca-Cola could sustain its early growth rates of its sales. It did. I mean, people, once you do the calculations, you'll find numbers of Coca-Cola projected back in the 1930s. There were projections of Coca-Cola selling billions and billions of bottles of Coke. And everyone said, well, obviously those growth rates are wrong. It's not going to be that. Well, it is. So sometimes it is, sometimes it is. Let me show you something here real quick. I'm going to pull up real quick an Excel table. And I'm going to show you how to do an amortization schedule real quick. Period. payment, interest, balance. Now, what I'm going to do is show you a classic amortization table. This will help you do a problem, one or two. Okay, let's say you decide you're going to buy a house for $225,000, APR, 30-year fixed rate, APR, 6.89%. Now, I'm going to put in the APR, like I said. Always put that somewhere so you can just reference it as a cell. Now, we are going to go from period zero all the way down 360 months. So I just type in zero and one, then grab the handle, and it'll run the numbers down. Okay, that's done. 360. Now the balance at the beginning is what you borrowed, $225,000. Now we have to calculate the payment. Equals PMT, open the parenthesis. The rate. Now that's G2. Now if you hit F4, that will turn that into an absolute reference because you don't want it to keep looking down farther. You want it to lock on the G2 where the rate is. So that's why I hit F4 and you get the dollar signs. But we want to divide that by 12 months. Now, comma, the number of periods. Well, why don't I just do it clear down here? I'm just going to put it clear down here at the end at 360. And again, lock it with an F4 so that it doesn't go snooping further. Comma, the present value, which is what you borrowed. And again, lock it, close the parenthesis. Your payments are going to be $1,480.35 a month. Now you're about ready to rock, okay? So your interest for the first month is going to equal the beginning balance of that month equals B2. 225,000 times your APR divided by 12. You paid $1,291.88 in interest on that first payment. You with it? Keep going. Now, what we're going to do next is we're going to take the balance at the end. So in other words, we're going to say, all right, it's going to equal the beginning balance minus, open parenthesis, the payment. Well, actually, I should make that an absolute value. the negative of that payment, actually, minus the interest that you paid. Again, let me explain that. Let me do something here. I should make that an absolute reference. ABS, because it's turning that into a... And so what I would do there is make absolute on that formula, and then I've got to fix this guy. Not a negative anymore. So your carryover balance is going to be equal to that right there. Watch the next trick. Highlight these two and bring them down one row. These three. My ass. What did I do wrong? Did I do an absolute reference? I screwed up. Well, let me... Control Z. Back that up. What did I do there? There was an absolute reference. B2 times G2. Oh! Yeah, G2 is an absolute reference. I was just testing you there. Did you see that? I didn't make it an absolute reference, so when I dragged it down, it slid from G2 to G3. That's very important to do those. Now let's try it again. Now, highlight those three cells, C2, C3, D2, and E2. Drag it down one. Now, why am I dragging it down one? Because now I have a complete row on row three. Watch this. Grab that handle and take it all the way to the end and look at that. Spank me. And actually, this one is irrelevant. See what happened? You paid off the loan at 360 months. That is an amortization table. It's worth it for you to have it for some of the problems. That's all I have for you. Thank you.